Participants and observers alike said there was a real sense that history was being made. That was the widespread feeling among those who took part or who closely followed the deliberations of the Second Vatican Council that opened on October the 11th, 1962, after almost 3 years of preparation.
Hic ad beati Petri sepulcrum, concilium ecumenicum Vaticanum secundum, solemniter initium capit.
Pope John XXIII surprised many when he had first announced that he was convening the council, saying there was a need to update and transform the church. The council lasted from 1962 to 1965 and produced 16 landmark documents. These documents modernized the liturgy, renewed the priesthood and religious life, enhanced the role of lay Catholics, opened dialogue with other churches and non-Christians, and identified the church as the people of God, attuned to the problems and hopes of the world. The 50th anniversary of that historic opening of the council coincides with the start of the Year of Faith, proclaimed by Pope Benedict for that very reason. But what were the feelings of the young seminarians and priests who were studying in Rome or elsewhere at the time of the Second Vatican Council? One of those was Patrick Kelly, now Archbishop of Liverpool in Britain. He was a postgraduate theology student in Rome when the council began its work and was present in St. Peter's Basilica for the opening session. He begins by recalling the prelude to the council and how the first inkling of what was to follow came when Pope John XXIII was elected to the papacy.
Well, I think we've got to go back a bit. We've got to go back to the excitement on the night that Pope John XXIII was elected. I remember it very well. I was in St. Peter's Square, and oddly enough, I've just had sent back to me a letter I wrote 2 days later to a priest in England. And among other things, I just happened to note in that letter, when the name John was given, there was a huge cheer, bigger than when they gave the cardinal's name. And I put in the letter, "Is this the first of many surprises?" That same night, I spoke with Monsignor William Hurd, who later became a cardinal, and he said to me that night, "This man knows what he wants, and he will get it." That, I think, is part of the picture. And therefore, I think when he announced in the sacristy of St. Paul's that he was going to call a general council, I thought, is this what is meant by he knows what he wants and he will get it? So there's that preparatory story. And then, of course, the opening itself. I was in St. Peter's, masquerading, if you like, as the secretary of my bishop, who, of course, was present. And my memory is of coming back to the college and saying to my fellow students, that opening address by the Holy Father was something I've not heard before. There was a tone of optimism, a tone of clarity, and a declaration that what wanted to be heard was good news. He actually, at that occasion, talked about the prophets of gloom and doom with whom he didn't agree because history did not bear them out.
There was a lot of interest in this event, not just in the Italian media and the church circles, but also around the world, wasn't there? Can you remember how it was being reported on in England at that time?
No, because I wasn't in England. I stayed in Rome.
Well, I meant perhaps you'd seen the papers, but anyhow.
Yes, because it sounds very odd. It was a long time ago in many ways. English papers didn't reach us. It sounds so odd now, with no internet and no, not the modern means. So we in a sense, probably saw it very much from the perspective of being in Rome. But of course, being youngish students in Rome, I think that's also part of what mustn't be forgotten, least for my memories.
And when that first document from the council was promulgated that paved the way for the celebration of the Mass in the vernacular, what was your personal reaction and that of your fellow students in Rome?
Well, what is so wonderful is the day it was actually submitted to the final vote, I had the flu. I remember it very well. I remember listening to the radio. Very rarely were we allowed radios, but I was to hear this. And the first thing I thought, and I still remember, is when the vote was cast, there was a spontaneous outburst of applause, and I felt I was back with those daring words from the Acts of the Apostles, "To seem good to the Holy Spirit and to us." Here was teaching confidence with assurance, not due to our merits, but because of the presence of the Holy Spirit.
Now, as we all know, not everybody in the church saw the council as a positive thing, and some Catholics claim that the changes and reforms were not interpreted or implemented correctly afterwards. What's your feeling on this?
I think it would be very hard after any council for implementation always to go smoothly. Again, that, like Pope John the 23rd insisted, know your history. So after some councils, it took decades before the implications of the council were completely understood and the right balances were achieved. But it always seemed to me, on certain pivotal questions, there was absolute clarity. For example, when it came to the liturgy, that the liturgy must communicate to those who take part. The problem is some people confuse communication almost with banality. But then we see the importance of symbols and poetry in the liturgy, because symbols and poetry communicate at a deeper level. And I think, and this may above all be true of the English-speaking world, because from the beginning when we had translations, since I'd had the possibility of learning other languages like Italian and French and some Spanish, I could see that some of our English versions were very thin compared with the richness of other languages, and that one day we'd need to have to revisit these things. So the intention was clear. The implementation, of course, would take quite some time.
The 50th anniversary of the opening of the council coincides with the start of the Year of the Faith proclaimed by Pope Benedict for this very reason. How do you personally feel about this initiative of the Year of the Faith?
I think it has huge potential in our own diocese, because already before this was announced, we were planning to strengthen what is called family catechesis, whereby we are seeking to make it possible for parents to fulfill the promises they make at the baptism of their child, and for the prayer made for them that they will be first and best teachers. We're trying to make sure that is a reality. So we are focusing very much already, and it is a real question of the faith handed on, to do all we can to enable not catechists to teach children, but catechists to work with parents who will then hand on the faith to their children. We've only just started this, and already the signs in many places are so positive. Parents saying, I need to know more. Some parents saying, who are not Catholics, I think I ought to consider whether it's now time for me to become a Catholic. So already we're seeing a deepening of faith and a strengthening handing on the faith, which I believe if we achieve that, and it's something the Holy Father, I know at least four occasions he's spoken of family catechesis, if we accomplish that, we will be very close to the heart of what the Holy Father is seeking.
Nonetheless, 50 years on from 1962, we're in a very much more secularized culture. What do you see as the greatest obstacles to evangelization, the new evangelization, this proclamation of the Year of the Faith?
I find it very hard to handle the description of secularization. If I put it like this, maybe because of specific history. If I, for example, only yesterday attended the funeral of Cardinal Paddy Bryson, 99 years old, former judge, former head of the British Legion, attended by the head of the police, attended by members of the council. If you said to me, what was the sign was, here are hearts open to the sort of prayer with which you accompany somebody through death. I have a slight fear we can talk up secularization, and I often think that Thomas More and Luther agreed on one thing. One thing the devil cannot stand is being mocked. And sometimes we may ascribe more power than actually is there. I find as I go around this city, what I'm impressed by is goodness and openness in abundance. Oh yes, we have our problems. But the way in which we are expected to be involved, be concerned, share the problems of every day is quite stunning. But it may be the fruit of many years of cooperation, especially not least the days of my predecessor, Archbishop Warlock, when with Bishop David Shepherd, very much implementing Unitatis Redemptor Gratio, worked together with the Methodist leader as well in days when this city was deeply troubled. They won a place in the whole life of the city which abides still today. So in many ways, I think there are open doors if we will present the richness and not some across. I think it's something which shines in the Holy Father. All the Holy Father's writings and words are a vision of the beauty of what we have to share. And if we do that, well, I think there's hunger for it.
Father Tony Convery was studying for the priesthood at the English College in Rome towards the end of the Second Vatican Council. He's now priest of a parish in Golders Green in northwest London. Father Convery said there was a euphoria and palpable sense of history being made among those like himself who were closely following the council's sessions.
In the college itself, we had the bishop staying there and we had daily reports of what was happening. The bishops lived in the college, many of them. They'd sit in the same dining room as we were around the building most of the time, and they often socialised with us in the evening. So there was a very palpable sense that it was happening among us. Yes, that was very, very strong indeed.
And was there widespread support for the documents that were coming out from the council?
Yes, indeed. I think the whole student body was affected by that. I remember a particular moment with great vividness. We were in the dining room before lunch one day, waiting to take our places for the meal, when it was announced that the pastoral constitution, Gaudium et Spes, on the Church in the Modern World, had just been agreed. And the mood of the bishops and the students was very upbeat. It seemed like a really important moment in the history of both the church and the world. You had the sense of being at the centre of a great institution that was in the process of fundamentally reviewing and changing its relationship to society and the world. And this feeling of being part of a great adventure within the church has never quite left me, even though the initial euphoria of those times inevitably faded.
So there really was a euphoria then?
Yes, there was. It felt like really great times were happening, and we were part of it. I was glad to be there. In the 1960s, I was sometimes derided for being unduly optimistic and even being pretentious about its own importance, but it was great to be there to see the changes that were overtaking the church and the world, and to glimpse the possibilities for Christian life which the new thinking had pointed to.
Now, I know there were many, many documents that came out, but in your view, was there one or two that really stand out above the rest of them?
I would guess that the two documents on the church had the most profound impression, certainly on the student body and on myself. That's Lumen Gentium and, of course, Gaudium et Spes, which I'd mentioned earlier. Those two really seemed to ground us in a vision of the church, which are profound and different, really. It was different to anything we'd ever really kind of perceived before. Those two documents were amazingly influential, I think.
But there weren't some people, when it came to, for instance, you know, the celebrating of the Mass in the vernacular, there weren't even then people who, even amongst your fellow seminarians, who were against that idea?
Well, of course, that had happened before I got to the college in Rome, because the constitution on the liturgy was the first pronouncement that came out a couple of years before. So we were already celebrating the vernacular liturgy, and in fact the student body as a whole had embraced that quite easily. I won't say there weren't some who would have looked back to the previous liturgy, but on the whole, I think the majority of the students were very positive about the new liturgy.
We're now 50 years on from then, and as you said, that euphoria is no longer there. But how would you feel about what was achieved during the Second Vatican Council with the wisdom of hindsight?
Well, I think that it was a kind of daring entered the bloodstream of the church at that time. No doubt some of it was silly and unrealistic, but it was exciting and it was attractive to young men who wanted to make their contribution. I think I've retained an attachment to that movement of ideas and innovation which took hold of the church, even though we now live in a very different state of affairs, both for the world and the church. But what I think was really fundamental, and really it's impossible to change now, is the idea that the church is really in the world. We can no longer, as we might have done, think that we could live within our own walls before, as we might have thought before the council. After the council, the relationship between the church and the world, although it's often uneasy, is now recognised as something that we've embraced, really, we've accepted it. And the church is now recognisably a global institution in a way that it wasn't before. And I think that that's been a profound change and one that still resonates with me.
I was speaking to Father Tony Convery, parish priest at Golders Green in northwest London. And earlier, you heard the voice of Archbishop Patrick Kelly of Liverpool.